Before I get started, but since we're being recorded, even if you know, even if people go join in late, they can tune in. In the original version of this class, pre-COVID, had offered the option of an early exam. Remember that? It seems like so long ago. I'm sure you've forgotten. I think it was May 13th instead of May 18th. I did not think that option was even necessary anymore, because the reason I was giving that early option is in case you have other plans, some siblings' graduation, a wedding. I think everybody's plans have been put on hold. So I'm going to stick with one exam on May 18th. But if you really, really, really still need to take the exam early, reach out to me and I will see if there's something we can do. Because for most of the people who are planning to take it early, why bother now? I mean, where are you going to go, right? So, Perry, you have a question?
I sent you an email on the internet connections. I'm not sure if you were.
Oh, thank you. I did look at it. I'm going to play with it today. I have a Mac, and it looked like it was for the two options given were Windows options. So I'll have to see if there's something equivalent on the Mac, because that will help if I can bundle both my...
Windows is very powerful. Like, I've done two phones and one Wi-Fi. It just patches speeds.
Okay, I will definitely check it out, because I'm sure there's a Mac variant that will work as well, because it shouldn't be system specific, because it looks like what the PC is doing.
That for you, no?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay, folks, any other questions before we start? Okay, so welcome and thank you for joining me. Today I think we're going to finish the real options section. And along the way, there's one final piece that may or may not apply to your project that we'll hit at. So if you remember the last session, we were talking about viewing the option to delay, and we use that to value patents and we use that to value natural resource reserves. And then we talked about the option to expand. And it's a very exciting option, because what it allows you to do is take an investment that's not financially viable. And the way you justify it is by telling about a big market out there that you could conquer if you do this, right? And already you can see this is a very, very dangerous door I've opened, because it allows companies to do really stupid things and justify it by saying, hey, there's a really big market out there. In a sense, this is the excuse that people have used, not just geographically to go into big markets like India or China, but also go into big markets like artificial intelligence. We're going to spend a lot of money. We know we're not going to make money on this project, but. So I'm going to suggest a test that needs to be run before people get carried away with using this option to justify doing stupid things. When I wrote a paper about 20 years ago, it's still on my website, and the title of this paper was Opportunities Are Not Options, because I got sick and tired of people saying, I'm in a big market, there must be an option, right? So here's the test I would run to allow this option argument to justify taking a big project. Remember that this option to expand, there are two projects that are connected at the hip, right? There's a bad project that gives you the right to an expansion option. So the first question I'm going to ask is, are those two bundled at the hip? Do I have to do the first project to get to the second? I don't know whether you remember, but one of the examples I used was Marriott opening 10 hotels in China, with the argument that if these 10 hotels do better than expected, China is such a big market that the option to expand is worth a lot. So here's a question I would ask Marriott. Do you need to open the 10 hotels to find out? Could you let Hilton open the 10 hotels instead and let them do the dirty work and use that to kind of make your decision? So the first question is, do I need to make the first investment to get to the second? The second is one of exclusivity. Let's say the first investment pays off. In the case of Marriott, let's say the 10 hotels are actually doing very well. Do you have the exclusive right to go into the rest of China? If your answer is no, which is probably going to be the answer, then I'm going to look at what kind of competitive advantage do you have because you took the first investment. What is it you learned on the first investment that's going to give you an advantage over everybody else? The more exclusive your right to the second investment, the greater the optionality. The less exclusive the right, the lower the optionality. So when I apply this test to a lot of strategic options or real options, here's what I see. I see very little exclusivity, in which case it's not that there's no option value, but the option values a fraction of what you thought it was. So think about that when you think about this option to expand, because it is in fact the test I would run on options to expand and whether they have value. So remember that three-part test we said you should apply to real options? Is there an option with an expansion project? Yes. The contingency is, if the present value of the cash flows exceed the cost of expansion, you should expand. So that's a good option being in the money. The present value of cash flows from expansion are less than the expansion costs, you should do nothing. So that there is an option. Second, is there exclusivity? It can vary. If in the case of Marriott, those 10 initial hotels gave you an exclusive license to go into the rest of China. Let's suppose that a province in China says, you come in, you open 10 hotels, but if you're the first hotel, and the first hotel chain that does this, we will give you an exclusive right. That is clearly an option. But if it's a weaker advantage that you know more about the market, you've learned more about the market, to very weak ones, which is we were there first, I'm going to get a lot more skeptical about the value of the option. So there is an option. Whether the option has value will depend on how much exclusivity you have. The third test is, can I use an option pricing model? Remember, to use an option pricing model, the underlying asset has to be traded. The option has to be traded. Well, neither is going to be the case with the option to expand. Neither the expansion option nor the project underlying it, the 100 more hotels you're going to open in China, are traded. This is about as weak a place to use option pricing as possible, which is one reason, again, that I'm not saying you cannot use option pricing, but I'm saying the value you get from an option pricing model, you should take with a grain of salt. So expansion options are what excites people, but they're also the places where option pricing models tend to be weakest. Any questions on the option to expand or variants thereof before we move on? Okay, so now we're going to talk about another application of options. Okay? In crisis periods, you realize the value of flexibility, right? You know what I mean by value of flexibility. It's nice to have excess debt capacity. It's nice to have cash on hand. It's nice to be able to walk away from mistakes. So there are two places where I'm going to use the option structure to explain why flexibility can have value. The first is the option to abandon a project. You're saying, why would I want to abandon a project? Think about many oil companies out there that took projects 4, 5, 6 years ago, or even last year when oil price was $60 a barrel. Do they wish they hadn't taken the project? Absolutely. Wouldn't it be nice if you could walk away from this project and give up on the rest of the project? Essentially, you'd still lose money that, you know, from the first 2 years, but you're not stuck losing money for the rest of eternity. That is the option to abandon. It's one of the few real options that is a put option. Almost every real option you're going to run into is a call option. If you remember the patent, the undeveloped oil reserve, the option expand, all call options, this is the only put option. Here's how it's structured. What you will get by abandoning a project, let's assume you get only 1/5 of your money back. That becomes the strike price. If the present value of the cash flows from continuing the project is less than that strike price, you abandon and you walk away. If that's not the case, well, you don't use the option. Like any other option, your losses are limited. So let me make this less abstract with an example. You're familiar with Lear Aircraft? Lear Aircraft is a company that produces mostly corporate jets. Let's assume Lear Aircraft has bigger ambitions. They want to make a bigger passenger aircraft, 40 to 50 passengers, and they don't have the capacity now to do it. But they're very good with small aircraft. So they approach Airbus and say, look, we know you don't have a small commercial aircraft. We are capable of doing that. Would you be interested in a joint venture? So let's do some role play. I'll be Lear Aircraft, you be Airbus. So we're going to go 50-50 on this. You're going to put in $500 million, I'm going to put in $500 million into this joint venture. So you do your homework as Airbus. You project out the cash flows from this 50% venture, and you come up with a present value of expected cash flows of only $480 million. You see, what do you mean only $480 million? Remember, you have to invest $500 million. If I stop right there, this is a negative net present value project for you, right? Minus $20 million. So you come back to me and say, we're not interested. This doesn't make sense for us. But I really, really, really want you to be my joint venture partner. So I come back to you with a counter offer. I say, look, if you enter into this deal and you change your mind any time over the next 5 years, we'll buy your 50% share back for 400 million, less than the 500 million that you invested, but I put a floor on your losses. You cannot lose more than 100 million. Do you see what I've given you? I've given you the option to abandon this project for the next 5 years, and if you do, what you will get is 400 million. Right now, you're not going to abandon it because the present value of the cash flows exceeds the 400 million. It's an out of the money put option. But if the value dropped to 300 or 320 million, I'm giving you a chance to walk away by limiting your losses to 100 million. We're going to value this put option. And to value this put option, I'm going to give you some additional information. I've done a variance. See this 480 million that came from the present value of the cash flows? Let's say I've done a Monte Carlo simulation on it. And the variance that I get in that present value is 0.16, which means it could be much higher, much lower. And the project itself has a life of 30 years. So before I show you the value of the option, think of where you are as Airbus. Right now, the project has a negative net present value of minus 20 million. You said, no, but I'm giving you this chance to walk away from a mistake. Let's see how much the option is worth, whether it's worth more than the minus 20 million. So to value this project, here's what I did. I took the present value of the cash flows. That becomes the S in the model. Right, the value of the underlying asset is the present value of the cash flows from continuing on this project. The strike price is what you will get if you abandon the project, 400 million. The variance is how much uncertainty there is in the 480 million, it's 0.16. You get the right to abandon this project anytime over the next 5 years. Remember, the project itself continues 30 years. You say, why aren't you giving me this right for the next 30 years? Because here's what I'm afraid you'll do. You'll be my partner for the next 29 years and 364 days, collect your cash flows, and on the very last day show up and say, you know what, I've decided to abandon the project, give me 400 million. So if I have any sense, I'm going to give you the right to abandon for only 5 out of the 30 years. But since this is a finite life project, over time, the present value of the cash flows will decrease. Again, for simplicity, I'm going to assume the present value decreases by 1 year each year. So basically, if I wait 1 year, then it becomes a 29-year project, a 28-year project, a 27-year project. But right now, because there's 30 years left, by waiting, I lose 3.3% of the value. The riskless rate is 6%. It's a 5-year riskless rate to match the life of the project. You ready? Here's what I get as the value of the put option, 73.23 million. You see, what does it even tell me? If you're Airbus, the option to be able to walk away from this project and floor your losses at 100 million is worth 73 million. Remember, the net present value is minus 20 million before I gave you this option? With the option added on, your net present value went positive. Doesn't guarantee that you'll be my joint venture partner, but do you see why this sweetens the pot? When you have the flexibility to walk away from your mistakes, it does make it more likely that you will take on big investments that you otherwise might not have taken. Big infrastructure investments, long-term investments. This is a way in which I could induce you to take a project. So I'll give you a place where this might play out. You know, much of the emerging, I mean, I'll take a country where I'm familiar with the infrastructure, India. India has very little infrastructure. Why? Because people don't want to invest in infrastructure. The government tries to do it, but they don't have the money. So let's assume the Indian government wants me to invest in infrastructure. You know what I'm going to say? Look, I don't want to do it. It's 40 years. You could change your mind and bad things can happen. And I could be stuck with a bad project. One way in which the Indian government can get me to invest in infrastructure is by saying, look, if you invest in the infrastructure, we will be the buyer of last resort, which means if you change your mind and walk away, we will pay you 75% of what you invested. I'll still lose money, but by limiting my losses, you might make it more likely that I'll invest in big projects, long-term projects, airports, toll roads, whatever you decide is a big infrastructure investment. The option to be able to walk away from your mistakes is a valuable option. And by putting in the put option structure, you can see how valuable it is. Any questions? Oh.
I was just
sorry, Nathan, I forgot. Thank you for reminding me.
I had a quick question, Celia. Yep. On slides 51 and 52, what was the relationship between the 30 years and the 5 years?
30 years is the life of the project. 5 years is the period over which you have the right to walk away from the project. So your right to abandon the project doesn't run all 30 years. It runs only for the first 5 years.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. I had a quick question. I'm
okay.
Sorry, Benjamin, you go first.
Yeah, I was just curious because just from a common sense perspective, I didn't quite understand why you would pay for the option to walk away.
Oh, you're not paying for it. You're getting it. So the $73 million is a put that I'm giving you, right? So I'm sorry if I was not clear. So the $73 million is what you as Airbus get as the put. So I'm giving you the put. So you're valuing it because you get the right to walk away. So you're not paying for it. You're receiving it. It's a gift from me to you. I'm saying, look, you know, you don't want to be my joint venture partner. What if I gifted you this put worth $73 million?
I guess what I'm having trouble understanding is if the project proceeds as expected,
right,
you would lose money.
On an expected, no, no, wait, back up. On an expected basis, your net present value is negative. But what is that variance? And if you drew a distribution of values, let's say 40% of the time, you'll make money, 60% of the time, you lose money. Your net present value is negative right now, right? But what is this option giving you? It's taking that 60% negative outcomes and taking the most negative outcomes out of the picture. You see what it's doing? So your original expected value of net minus 20 million was across all positive and negative outcomes. But by giving you the option to abandon, I'm taking your worst possible outcomes out of the picture. And by doing it, I'm making it more likely for you to be a good investment.
I have a question. How does this affect the NPV of Lear?
Oh, that's a good question, because the question, if I'm giving this to you, my net present value as Lear has to be much, much, much greater than 53.23 million, right? Because if I give this to you and my net present value is also minus 20 million, guess what happened to my overall net present value after I give this investment, give this to you? It's going to become minus 73.23 million. So I have to have enough value from my side of the equation. Maybe as Lear, I'm getting other side benefits. But that's a good point. When I give away this option, somebody is paying for it. In this case, it's Lear that's paying for it, and they better have a net present value that exceeds that.
So you
can have two joint venture partners who actually get different net present values from the same project. Okay, Darshan, you had a question or no?
That's fine.
So the implication here is a very simple one. When you take long-term projects, and this is particularly true with long-term projects, you want to build an escape hatch. It's a common sense rationale, but it's amazing how companies seem to think that building an escape clause is a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of good sense. More cost flexibility, fewer long-term contracts, because the more you lock yourself into these long-term projects, if things don't work out, you're going to have a really tough time extricating yourself from it. We're going to see which oil companies scale down and scale up easier than others, right? Because this crises like this in general, test companies, they test companies on how quickly you can scale down, which is just another word for flexibility. And the more flexible you are, the more valuable you'll be as a company. Any other questions on the option to abandon? Okay, so let's move on to options in capital structure. Most of the options in capital structure are in the design of securities. What am I talking about? I'm talking about convertible bonds. There's an option there, right? It's a conversion option. All floating rate debt with caps and floors. You know what caps and floors are? Usually when you have floating rate debt, the interest rate cannot exceed a certain number or cannot go below a certain number. Anytime you put a cap or a floor on interest rates, you're building in options. So most of the time when people talk about options in fixed income, they're talking about valuing options in bonds. That's not the option I want to talk about. There's a fixed income class for that. You can take that. The option I want to talk about is, in my view, a much more interesting one. I know some of you are in my corporate finance class, but one of the things we do right now, and many of you were in my corporate finance class last semester or last spring. And if you remember, we did the optimal debt ratios for companies. Remember that? Long time ago, if you took it in last spring, where we said the optimal debt ratio for the company is where your cost of capital is minimized, and we stated a number. When I first started doing that and talking to companies about their optimal debt ratios, I got very frustrated, because here's what would happen. You'd go to a company with no debt and you'd compute their optimal debt ratio and tell them you have a 30% optimal debt ratio. You have excess debt capacity. And they say, we can't borrow money. And I say, why can't you borrow money? And they say, we value financial flexibility. That's a really good sounding word. How can you argue against financial flexibility? That's like arguing against apple pie and motherhood and all the good things in life. So it used to stop me. And then I started thinking about, what is the value of financial flexibility? Clearly, it has to have value for so many people to talk about it. So I started thinking in terms of options. And here's what I see as the value of financial flexibility. What I mean by financial flexibility is that you have either excess debt capacity or huge cash balances. Why are you doing this? Just in case. Just in case what happens? First, just in case you get hit with a shock, a recession if you're a cyclical firm, or a loss of a contract if you're a company with three big contracts. But you also get the flexibility to take a project, an incredibly good project that comes along that you normally would not be able to take, but now that you have that large cash balance or debt capacity, you might be able to take that project. So I said the value of financial flexibility gives you the option to take these incredible projects you otherwise couldn't have taken. That's where I started this thought. And I said, maybe I can make it into something more specific, because it was very fuzzy at that point. So here's the way I'm going to structure the value of financial flexibility, having excess debt capacity. Let's assume that there's a certain amount of reinvestment you can fund without flexibility. So basically, given your internal cash flows, normal access to debt, let's say you can fund $5 billion worth of projects. So that becomes your strike price. You say, what do I need flexibility for? Let's suppose you get a project that needs $15 billion, much more than you can normally fund. Here's the advantage of having financing flexibility, either excess debt capacity or lots of cash built up. You can use that excess debt capacity or lots of cash to take that incredibly good project, that $15 billion project. What do you gain by taking the project? You get the net present value. So basically, taking the project itself doesn't have value. It's a net present value in the project. So I'm going to argue that financial flexibility has value because you can now take these incredible projects that you otherwise couldn't have taken because you have set aside either excess debt capacity or cash to cover the difference. You're saying, what if that never happens? Well, that great project might never show up, in which case, what have you lost? Remember, by having excess debt capacity, you ended up with a cost of capital higher than the cost of capital you could have had at the optimal debt ratio. Think of that as the cost of this option. I know it sounds incredibly abstract, but I'm actually going to take a company to illustrate this process. But more important than the option value that I get will be the insights we get about what kinds of companies should value financial flexibility the most, and you can tell me whether it makes sense. So I'm going to take you back to the late 1990s. I wrote the first edition of my Applied Corporate Finance book. I used to compute optimal debt ratios the same way then as I do now. Look at where the cost of capital is minimized. So this was Disney's cost of capital at different debt ratios. Should be very familiar for those of you from my corporate finance classes, right? Different debt ratios, that's my cost of capital. What's our definition of optimal? Where the cost of capital is minimized, right? There it is. That's a 40% optimal. They were actually at an 18% debt ratio. Their cost of capital in 18%.
For one sec.
Yeah.
Just to be clear on the framework. So you're saying that the opportunity cost of maintaining financial flexibility represents like the option premium.
Exactly.
To develop the future project that may be valuable is the strike price. And the potential payout is the potential upside in future cash flows of the potential project.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So here's what I have. I have a 12.22% cost of capital. They could be at 11.64%. Let's say I go into Disney and make this pitch. You should be at a 40% debt ratio. And Disney says, no, we're not going to go there because we value financial flexibility. Now, that's almost impossible to contend with right off the top. So basically, I want to value financial flexibility so I can compare it to how much money I've left on the table here by being under levered. So here's how I structured my option. I said, okay, Let me first figure out how much Disney will have as reinvestment needs by looking at the past. So I took the net capex and change in working capital, what they were reinvesting each year as a percentage of their value, and the average for that number was about 5.3% a year. What does that mean? Each year they were reinvesting about 5.3% of their overall market value back into the company in acquisitions, net capex, working capital. That number jumped around. The variance in that number was 0.375. So it's not 5.3% every year. It's, you know, 12% 1 year, 3% the next. So variance is the captures the variability in that reinvestment. The amount that they could get from internal funding, which is just retained earnings, their normal access to debt, was about 4.8%. So I've got S, I've got the variance, I've got the strike price. I'm going to value financial flexibility on an annual basis. Why? Because then I can compare it to the 58 basis points I'm giving up by being under level. I know it's an incredibly messy option, but kind of hang in there. Because when I valued it as an option, I got 1.6092%. You say, what does that even mean? That is the value of taking a project. But if your projects have zero net present value, the option's worth nothing, right? So then the question I had to ask was, what does a typical project for Disney bring in terms of positive net present value? And I'm piling assumptions on top of assumptions, but here's what I assume. In 1997, Disney's return on capital was 18.69%. Their cost of capital was 12.22%. If I make the assumption that a typical project continues to generate those same excess returns, 6.47%, you can then compute a net present value very simply by taking that excess return and assuming you earn it in perpetuity. 12.22% is my cost of capital. I get a value flexibility of 0.85% of value. I know I piled bunches of assumptions on top of each other, but here's what I get. By being underlevered, they give up 58 basis points as cost of capital because their cost of capital is higher than it needs to be. But being underlevered, to the extent that you try to believe these numbers, they gain 85% of value because they preserve flexibility. 85% is greater than 58%, or 0.85% is greater than 0.58%. Therefore, Disney is on solid ground saying we're going to stay underlevered. I'll be quite honest, I would not actually use this option pricing approach to value financial flexibility in individual companies, because here's what I get out of this approach that I think is more useful. I get insight into what kinds of companies should value flexibility the most. Or put differently, what kinds of companies which are underlevered, where I'm not going to push the company to move towards their optimal. So let me draw some conclusions and you tell me whether you agree with the option pricing approach or not, whether this makes sense. Remember that the value of the option came from the fact that there's this great project that came along that you now are able to take because you maintain financial flexibility. If you were a company with absolutely no capital constraints, you know what I mean by that? You can always go out and raise as much capital as you want. The value of financial flexibility very quickly goes to zero. So the more capital constraints you face as a company, the more you should value financial flexibility. So here's the bottom line. If you're a company which produces large positive cash flows, you're a stable, mature company, you should value financial flexibility more than a company that has very low cash flows or negative cash flows. Netflix should value financial flexibility a lot more than Apple should. But why? Because Netflix has very low and perhaps negative operating cash flows. Companies with easy access to capital markets should have lower value for financial flexibility than companies without that access. Like whom? I would expect private companies to value financial flexibility more than public companies. I would expect small public companies to value financial flexibility more than large public companies. I would expect emerging market companies to value financial flexibility more than developed market companies. Why? Because the greater the capital constraint, the greater the value to flexibility. So that's the first factor. Tell me something about your capital constraints, or at least I guess it by looking at who you are as a company. The second is the more unpredictable your reinvestment needs are, the greater the value financial flexibility. The way this shows up in the option pricing model is in that variance in reinvestment. If you're a utility with well-set reinvestment needs, you know exactly what you will need to reinvest next year, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now. You should value financial flexibility less than a technology company where the reinvestment needs can jump around. But most critically, if you are a company in a business that generates well above the cost of capital, you should value financial flexibility. If you're an automobile company, an airline company, don't even talk to me about the value of financial flexibility, because you're in a business where earning excess returns is so difficult to do. So the greater your capacity to earn excess returns, the more you should value financial flexibility. So it gives you insights into where companies should be underlevered. So if you're in my corporate finance class, if your company's underlevered, maybe you want to look at, hey, you know, do they face capital constraints? How unpredictable are the reinvestment needs? What are the excess returns they earn? Because those can all inform you on the judgment you make on whether they should move to the optimal. Because the smaller companies with unpredictable reinvestment needs, you should probably let them keep their financial flexibility. And not just push them up to, but they remember, at the limit, not only can you not borrow money, you can accumulate cash. And this is an argument for why some companies should be allowed to accumulate cash. Darshan?
Just taking case for airlines, wouldn't airlines be able to reduce their chance of failure if they had more cash with them?
They are, but what if it's a bad business? Do you see the quandary you're faced with here? If it's a bad business, you've reduced your chance of failure, but at what expense? So there's that other aspect of financial flexibility. If you reduce your chance of failure enough, maybe it's worth it. So bringing in the failure risk and distress risk might be one other reason why you hold back and pushing up to the optimal. But I think with airlines, it's more a question of don't get over-levered, not stay under-levered. The problem for the airlines was not that they were correctly levered and the crisis made them over-levered. They were over-levered to begin with. You compute the optimal debt ratio. Every airline that people in this class have looked at in the last year, 2 years, 3 years, they found them to be over-levered. The entire business borrowed more than it should. So I think it's less an argument for airlines should be under-levered than, and more an argument for don't get over-levered in the first place. With Boeing, maybe this argument can be played out. The failure risk, I think, is a stronger one.
Professor, I have a question on the cash. So if it was the case that they were piling on cash instead of borrowing more, would then the cost be instead of different cost of capital just for non-income and cash?
Well, you can even think in terms of net debt ratios, right? Remember, we defined net debt as debt minus cash. Let's say your optimal net debt ratio is 20%, because we can do the whole thing with net debt. You can actually end up with a minus 20% net debt ratio if you accumulate enough cash. So rather than thinking of cash and debt as different phenomena, just put them on the same axis. So you're a very conservative firm with a very, very strong capital constraints, and you're in a good business. Not only would I advise you not to borrow money, I'd advise you to accumulate cash, because I want you to survive and stay on in this great business.
Thanks.
Asaf? Your question, Asaf?
I have a question about the previous slide. Can you please go back to it? So the 0.58% is the change in cost of capital.
If you go to the optimal, they're choosing not to go to the optimal, so that's what they give up.
But it's a change, it's a difference in cost of capital.
Right.
So my question is whether to compare it to the 0.85%, shouldn't we translate it to the change in value of the...
No, because I value the flexibility on an annual basis. That's what when I value the option, because you basically get this option for the long term. By putting T equal to 1, I've converted the value into a 1-year value. So think of it as almost as an annual value. So your company value will actually increase by a lot more than that, because you get this year after year after year.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Any other questions? Sergio, you said, when do you consider cash to incorporate? So I think I answered Sergio's question about net debt. So think in terms of net debt ratios. In fact, I am surprised actually that emerging market companies, especially in very, very capital constrained emerging markets, don't first borrow money in the first place, but also don't accumulate more cash, because it makes sense given where they are that they want to preserve financial flexibility. Which brings me to my final application of options. I'm going to value equity in a publicly traded company as an option, especially as the company gets more distressed. Sounds weird, but let me go back to first principles here. Remember what equity in a publicly traded company gives you. It gives you a residual claim. It entitles you to whatever's left over in the company after everybody else has been paid, right? And with publicly traded companies, you also have limited liability. You know what that means? Your stock can never drop below zero. And thank God for that. Can you imagine if your broker kept calling you saying your stock price is now minus 17, minus 23, minus 25 and asking you to send more money? It's a combination of a residual claim and the fact that you have limited liability that makes equity look like a call option. You see, what are you talking about? We set up a very simple payoff diagram. You play the role of equity investors in a company, and I'll be a lender to the company. So I've loaned you money. You're contractually obligated to pay me the money back. So let's treat that as a strike price. You get to run the firm. You can liquidate the firm at any time. If you liquidate the firm, let's say you get the value of its assets. Let's call that S. If the value of the firm exceeds the face value of the debt, you keep the difference. If the value of the firm, and you pay me off fully, if the value of the firm is less than the face value of the debt, guess what you do? You say limited liability, I'm walking away. In which case, what did you lose? You lose what you originally paid for the stock. Equity in a publicly traded company takes on the characteristics of a call option, with the strike price being the debt coming due, the life of the option being however many years you get before you pay off the debt, and the value of the business becoming the value of the underlying asset. I know it sounds incredibly obtuse, but let me use a very simple example. And I'm going to extract every conceivable bottom line I can from this example. Let's assume I have a company where the assets currently have a value of 100 million. Don't even ask me how I came up with it. I would have done in a DCF, I've come up with a $100 million value. The standard deviation in that value is 40%. So there's a lot of uncertainty about the value. It could go up, it could go down. Let's assume that this company has 1-0 coupon bond outstanding with 10 years to expiration and an $80 million face value. You're going to see in a minute why I had to make it a zero coupon bond. It makes my life easier. It's a convenience assumption. The 10-year bond rate is 10%. So I've given you the value of the firm, the standard deviation of the value, the face value of the debt, and when the debt comes due, and it's a zero coupon bond. So no payments due for the next 10 years. At the end of the 10th year, I have to pay $80 million. The risk-free rate is 10%. I'm going to argue that with this limited information that I've given you, you should be able to tell me how much the equity in this company is worth and what interest rate you would charge on the debt. I haven't given you betas, cost of equity, cost of capital, ratings, nothing. I'm going to argue with the information. You should be able to answer those two questions. Saying, how the heck are we going to do that? Let me structure the problem. Remember, you play the role of equity investors, I'll be the lender. So the value of the underlying business becomes the S, that's 100 million. The liquidation option is the option you possess, but if you liquidate the firm, you have to pay me 80 million. Let's assume that that's the case, whether you liquidate in year 1, year 2, year 3, year 5, or you wait till the end of year 10. 80 million becomes the strike price. The life of the option becomes the life of the bond, 10 years. Why 10 years? Because for the next 9 years and 364 days, I have absolutely no power as the lender to make you do anything. Now do you see why I made it a nice zero coupon bond? With a regular coupon bond, you would still have an option, but you'd have a bunch of options piled on top of each other. Why? Because at the end of 6 months, you'd have to pay me interest. At the end of the year, more interest. So every 6 months, I'd get some power. I'm trying to keep my calculation simpler by making it a zero coupon bond. It's not realistic, but it'll make my initial computation at least quicker. The variance in the value is 0.4 squared, which is 0.16. The riskless rate is 10%. S, K, T, sigma, and R. I have all the inputs I need. There's no equivalent of a dividend yield here because there is no, in this case, let's assume there are no dividends being paid. If there were dividends, I'd have put dividend yield in there. So here's what I get. As D1 and D2. Remember the process by which we use Black-Scholes. We plug the numbers into D1 and D2. We get D1 and D2. We go to the cumulative normal distribution. We get N of D1 and N of D2. Remember again what NFD2 measured? It measured the probability that this option will be in the money. There's a 63% chance that S will be greater than K. You're saying, who cares? What's S in this case? It's the value of the firm. K is the outstanding debt. There's a 63% chance that the value of the firm will be greater than the value of the outstanding debt, which means there's a 37% chance of what? What happens if the value of the firm falls below the value of the debt? And the company goes bankrupt. There's a 37% chance of bankruptcy. There's actually an outfit called KMV. It's a West Coast based outfit where banks can go with their loan portfolios. You know what KMV does? It estimates the probability of default on that, of bankruptcy. You're saying, how do they do it? They use an option pricing model. It's much more sophisticated than this one. They come up with the equivalent of ND2, and then they say 1 minus that number is the probability of bankruptcy here. In this company, there's a 37% chance of bankruptcy. But notwithstanding that high chance of bankruptcy, the value of the equity, valued as a call option, because that's what you own, is 75.94 million. Which means that the rest has to be debt. 100 million minus 75.94 is the value of the debt. Remember, it's a zero coupon bond. Face value 80 million, value today is 24.06 million. I can compute the interest rate I would get from those two numbers to be 12.77%. With the minimalist information, I was able to value the equity and tell you what interest rate I would charge on the bond. And also, as a bonus, tell you what the likelihood of bankruptcy will be in this company. I want everybody to get at least comfortable with the intuition of what I'm doing, because I'm going to use this as my starting example and do some what ifs on it. But essentially, I'm valuing equity in this company, but I'm valuing it as a call option. What that call option is the value of the option to liquidate. And it's deriving its value from the fact that I owe a lot of money. And if the value of my firm falls below that outstanding money, my equity is floored at zero. Therefore, I cannot lose more than what I paid for the stock. And that optionality is what's driving the value of the equity. Any questions? The value of the call is the value of the equity in this company. The total value of the company is 100 million. The value of the equity in this company is 75.94 million.
If you were to do this in a company with no debt,
it won't. No, it won't work. There's no liquidation option in a company like that. You need debt, and that's why only a subset of you are going to be able to apply this on your company, because not only do you have to be a money losing company, you have to be a money losing company with a lot of debt. You're valuing an airline, this works great. You're valuing Zoom, it's not going to work. So this requires that you have that big debt payment, because the option to liquidate comes from the fact that if the value of your business drops below that debt, you're floored at zero. That's where the optionality comes in. So let's play some what if games. Let's assume you listen to me, bad mistake, and you buy the equity at 75.94 million. Tomorrow you wake up to some horrendous news. Half the company has been wiped out. Don't even ask me how. Now you have two factories, one in California, one in Florida. You take your pick, hurricane or earthquake. One of the factories is demolished and it's not insured. The value of the firm drops from 100 million down to 50 million. The face value of the debt still remains 80 million. So I'm going to ask you a question about what your equity will be worth after this really bad news. Remember, it used to be worth 75.94 million? So here are the potential answers, and you tell me which one you think is going to be the right answer. I could take the 75.94 and subtract out the 50 million and get 25.94. I can listen to my accountants who are going to tell me your company is bankrupt, because remember, the book value of equity would have turned negative with this $50 million write-off. Or maybe the value of the equity has to be greater than 25.94 million. So here are your choices: 25.94 million, zero, or more than 25.94 million. What do you think the answer is going to be? Perry, you said C. Jessica, you said B. Are you listening to your accountants? I guess you are, right? Because when it is true, the book value of equity will turn negative. But what do you have going for you? You're the equity investor in the company. When is the debt due, Jessica?
10 years from now.
So for the next 9 years and 364 days, you can continue to run the company, right? And what do we say about the variance? That there's a lot of uncertainty about the future. The 50 million today could very well become 150, 200. You see, what are the chances of that happening? Well, maybe they're low, but do you see what's happening here? As long as you have time as your ally, your equity will still be worth something, right? Because something good could happen. Then you hope that something good happens and you pray that something good happens. Most of the time, nothing good might happen, but just because you have an out-of-the-money option doesn't mean it's worth nothing. So I'm glad we came to a consensus here. Let's not listen to the accountant. So B is, no, let's cross it out. The real choice is between, should I drop it by 50 or less than 50? Perry, let me put you on. You said it'll be worth more than 25.94 million. Okay, I'll go along. So if that is the case, then I'm losing less than 50 million, right? Which must mean somebody else is losing money. Who else is in this game that I can pass off some of the loss to?
The debt holders, because if you exit today, and like if there's a liquidation event today, 30 million of the loss.
And it's not even a liquidation event, right? Remember the probability of bankruptcy we estimated earlier at 37%? What do you think's happened to that number after this catastrophe?
That's gone up.
Exactly.
That's gone up.
Exactly. So let's see exactly what happens. And this is actually where it gets interesting. I'm going to take the value of the firm, drop it from 100 to 50 million, right? Everything else about the option stays the same. You still have 10 years. You still have an $80 million bond. You still have the same variance. You can say, how can the variance be the same? The variance is the percentage change around whatever value you have. My firm is worth half of what it was before, but the uncertainty in that value is driven around that half. So it's still 0.16. And the T-bond rate is still 10%. So I'll remind you again, your equity was worth 75.94 million before, right? See what it's worth now? 30.44. Your equity has dropped, but it has dropped by only 45.5 million. You say, what do you mean only 45.5 million? Well, remember the total loss in value was 50 million, but you lost only 45.5 million. Where did the other $4.5 million loss go? My debt went from 24.06 to 19.56. Why did my debt drop? Remember that probability of bankruptcy was 37% before? It is now 58%, 58.5%. My firm is now more likely to go bankrupt. My debt is worth less. My equity is also worth less. But it doesn't drop by the full amount of the drop in value because there's somebody else I'm dragging into the game. Unwillingly, the lender doesn't want to be part of this. But it's part of the reason why when you see a drop in value, you can't just automatically take it out of the value of equity. Once I got started doing this, I could not stop. Let me explain. Remember I dropped the value of the firm to 50? I dropped it to 40, then to 30, then to 20, then to 10, keeping everything else fixed. You know what I wanted to find out? When does equity become worthless? How basket case will I have to make this company for the equity to be worth? And here's what I found. I could not make the equity value go away. It's an incredibly stubborn instrument. I dropped the value of the firm to 10 million, 5 million, 3 million. The equity still hung in there. It's a complete and total basket case company, right? Because if your value of the assets is 10 million, you owe 80 million debt. So why would I pay for the equity? You know why you're willing to pay for the equity? For the same reasons.
On the upside, right?
It's a deep out of the money option. You're buying it for the same reasons you buy deep out of the money options. And most of the time when you buy deep out of the money options, what happens to the option? It goes
worthless.
It goes to zero. But when it pays off, guess how it pays off? It pays off by taking your money, not just doubling your money, but increasing it 20-fold. I'll give you an example. In 1993, Continental Airlines, United's earlier namesake, Continental Airlines was trading at $1 per share. You know why it was trading at $1 per share? Because the company was technically bankrupt. So if you were looking at airlines, this isn't the first time this has happened to airlines. $1 per share. On every dimension, it was a basket case company. Negative book value of equity, it had been losing money, huge debt burden. If you'd bought Continental Airlines at $1 per share, A year and a half later, that stock was trading at $53 per share. $53 per share. That's a 5,200% return. You're saying, how did that happen? Because when you have a lot of debt, if the value of your firm changes even by a small amount, as it gets above the equity value, your equity is going to explode out of the box. Equity in deeply distressed firms does not cease to have value just because the value of the firm has dropped. It will start to behave like an option. Keep that in mind, because I'm going to come back and put you on the spot and say, once your equity starts to behave like an option, what's going to drive that value? And it's going to change some things we've taken for granted on their head. Things like risk. Risk will now magically become your ally, not your enemy, because equity is now an option. So that's the first thing to think about when you think about equity as an option. Any questions before Keenan?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can you explain the intuition behind this again?
I don't think I really understand.
As the firm approaches bankruptcy based on a higher debt to equity ratio, the bondholder holds more of the downside fallout.
Exactly.
So,
it's a limited liability. Basically, what you have is, you buy equity when the value is $10 million. You might pay a little amount for it, and most of the time you're going to write it off. But in this firm, remember, with the variance, there's still a chance the firm can come back to life. That chance is what's driving the value of your equity.
So the payoff is still just as big, but the chances are just lower.
The payoff is even bigger on a percentage basis. Do you see why? Because your equity has become such a tiny slice of the overall firm that when the firm recovers, that tiny slice can very quickly increase in value tenfold, 20-fold. So it's behaving like an option from that perspective, because there's nothing more to lose. You're already bankrupt. What can I do to you? It's like drowning in water. Does it matter whether you're drowning 5 feet or 50 feet? Either way, you're dead. So as an equity investor in this deeply troubled firm, you're essentially willing to take on more and more risk because the upside belongs to you and the downside belongs to the lenders.
So like safe intuition is sweet equity in a private equity deal. If you have even a tiny slice and you put all the risk on someone else, your option is still worth a lot if it works out.
Exactly. And the more time you have to work out, the greater the value of the option.
Right.
So it's better to have long-term debt than short-term debt. Because as your debt comes due, the optionality disappears, right? Because as you get closer and closer to the due date on the debt holder takes power.
Right, because the real end game is just what you actually have to pay.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
And where do you see this in the Black-Scholes formula?
In the T in the model and the variance, right? The two things. The T tells you how much time you have before your debt comes due. And the variance tells you how much uncertainty there is in the value.
Mm-hmm.
So you want lots of uncertainty and you want a long T.
Got it. So as variance goes up, you start to see the call option value climb up
exactly.
Slowly.
Do you see why now everything changes on its head? Because up till now we said risk is bad, it will reduce your value. Now all of a sudden we're saying, no, risk is good. Why? Because you're so far underwater that you want risk to come in to push your value up. You don't want to buy equity in a deeply distressed, stable company. I don't even know what that would mean. You want to buy deeply distressed, volatile companies because you need upside. And for that upside to happen, you need volatility.
Is this where, is this approaching the line of like where distressed debt investing starts to see the economics of buying kind of like fulcrum security debt workout?
If you're a distressed debt holder, you better have some degree of control over who runs a company, right? Because if you let the equity investors run the company, guess what they're going to do? They're going to keep gambling and gambling because they have nothing to lose anymore. So if you're a distressed debt holder, you're looking for at least a stake in the equity and a way in which you control how the company is run. So if you lend to otherwise you're going to end up, holding the bag while the equity investors get all the upside.
Got it. Thank you.
Sam?
Yeah, I was interested in how PG&E is thought about in terms of an option.
It is definitely an option. PG&E, for those of you not familiar, is the utility that covers Northern California. It is technically in bankruptcy, but I think the problem with PG&E is it's not just between the debt and the equity. The government is a player. You have all kinds of side players, which makes it very dangerous to play the distressed equity game, as the government can step in and say, okay, will bail you out, but in return, the equity investors are all wiped out. That would be my cautionary note in PG&E, is as long as the government is a player, it might risk make your game a lot riskier to play. Jose, you're saying you're equating stock price volatility. You're right. I'm not talking even about cash flows. I'm saying your value as a company will be volatile, whether it's volatile because the cash flows are volatile or something else makes it move to be macro variables. I don't know. But you're right. We are talking about volatility in value. And if we want to do it intrinsically, we might have to talk about, you know, doing this as a Monte Carlo simulation. But I'm not talking about stock price variance per se. I'm talking about volatility, the value of the firm. Okay. Darshan?
So when a company enters bankruptcy, it's almost certain that, it's almost like, it's like 99% certain that there is no value for equity, and whatever is left out is going to be taken over by
Well, in the US, it's a little fuzzy because you can enter bankruptcy. One of the reasons the equity value tends to disappear the minute you declare Chapter 11 is equity investors don't run the company anymore. The court runs the company. The court appoints. So that's, I think, the troubling aspect of actually entering bankruptcy proceedings. The equity option starts to dissipate. But to the degree that you can enter bankruptcy and exit bankruptcy because you did come to a restructuring agreement, you could exit. You can still have openings, but the equity value does drop off once you officially declare bankruptcy. The equity option has the most value if you're on the verge of bankruptcy, but you actually haven't gone over the edge.
Right, so it only works for companies that are on cusp, like there might be some value.
I'll tell you what, if you're valuing an airline today, none of them have declared bankruptcy as far as I know, right? I would argue any airline today, your equity value is really an option value. It's not going to be a DCF value because this is not, you know, equity value is positive, DCF value is zero. It could just be the premium you're willing to pay over the DCF value. And I think with these airlines, there is a premium that comes from the option out here. And that's something that this option pricing models are going to allow you to capture.
And that's because there's time. So basically,
exactly.
An airline might not be forced to bankruptcy, like for 2 years now.
If they have enough cash flows to tide them over, because Boeing recently just went out and raised capital to cover the near-term debt payments. Because remember, all they have to do is make it through over 2 years, and you know the business is coming back. So that's why the optionality argument is a pretty easy one to apply to airlines or to infrastructure companies that are in trouble right now, because all they need to do is tide through the next year or two by coming up with enough cash flows to service the debt payments. Because once they make the interest payment, the bank can look at them and say, you're a terrible company, but they can't do a thing because the interest payments have been met.
Right. So they cannot take the control of the
exactly.
I mean, they cannot force them to bankrupt.
Exactly. Exactly. You got to miss a contractual payment for all of that stuff to kick in. And these companies, I think, will be able to raise the money unless there's another shock to the system.
Yeah.
So now let's talk about a second example. And this is going to be fascinating because it's going to make you revisit things in corporate finance that we thought we'd put to rest. So let's go back to the original firm before the catastrophe occurred. $100 million value. Equity was 75.94, debt was 24.06, the value of the firm was 100 million. You ready? I'm going to come to you with a project, and you tell me whether you take the project. So I come to you with a project with a negative net present value of 2 million. Already, what are you saying? Why would I take a negative net present value project? You say, but wait. This project not only has a negative net present value, it's a very risky project. You're saying this is going from bad to worse. You want me to take a negative net present value with a lot of risk? You're the equity investor. Can you visualize a scenario where you take this bad project and you actually emerge from the process better off than you were before you took this bad, risky project? What's going to happen if you take this project? Let's go step by step. If I take a negative net present value project, minus 2 million, what happens to my value as a firm? Julian says I gave the answer away. Julian, you want to unmute yourself, because let me take me through the process of how I gave the answer. So firm value goes down, right? From 100 to 98 million. Okay.
Yep.
That's bad, right? My debt is still 80 million. I still have 10 years. But remember, by taking this project, I made the company a riskier company.
Yep.
0.25. You know what's going to happen to the value? This is like magic. I took a bad, risky project. My value equity went from 75.94 to 77.71 million. But you know who got screwed over? My debt holders saw their value drop by 3.8. This is a cautionary note to banks that lend to levered companies. Because when you lend to very highly levered companies as a bank and you don't take a role in how the companies run, the company is not going to be run more conservatively. It's going to take more risk. Why? Because as an equity investor, once you become an option holder, you want risk. You don't want to be safe. And this is something that lies at the heart of the conflict between stocks and bonds. Sam says one thing that debt holders try to do is write in covenants, but covenants alone won't do it. You need somebody in the room. Have you seen the Hamilton movie? No, the Hamilton play, you know. So basically, you want to be in the room when the big decisions get made, right? I can't sing the song, but you can sing it to yourself. No. So essentially, you want to be in the room when big projects are taken. You cannot let equity investors run the company. You have to have an active role in management, because if you don't, you're going to get taken to the cleaners. So that's, again, a simple lesson you get by just playing this game of what happens to equity in highly levered companies. Let me do one final example with this. I'm killing this example in terms of adding more things, but let me add one more final example. Let's assume you're the manager of this firm that I just described, $100 million value firm, and you go out and acquire another firm. Now, we're going to talk about all the terrible things that happen in acquisitions, but let's say you do the right thing. You pay fair market value. No. So essentially, you take a firm of $150 million, you pay exactly $150 million. That's like taking a zero net present value project, right? So what should happen to your stock price? Your first reaction is zero net present value. Nothing should happen. But let's see if that is true using the option frame. Yeah, go ahead.
Wouldn't the risk go down for the company?
That's exactly it. But the overall firm value will not change. Remember, the overall firm value is based upon the risk you cannot diversify away. But so the drop in risk will not increase your value as a firm, because it's risk that you wouldn't have counted in your BEIT and your cost of equity and cost of capital. So I should have before in this example described these as two publicly traded companies. They're publicly traded. The combined company might be less risky, but the value of the combined company will not increase because that risk wasn't counted in the discount rate anyway. But let's see if your equity value is affected. And I think you've already latched on to why the equity value might be impacted. Here's what I did. I took the two companies. There's firm A, that's your company. There's firm B, the company you're planning to acquire. I've given you the specifics. So company A has 80 million debt, company B has 50 million. I've given you the standard deviations of the two companies. And then I give you a correlation between these companies' cash flows. Basically, that 0.4 means that these two companies are in different businesses. Their cash flows move together some of the time, but not all of the time. You're saying, who cares? You know what's going to happen to the combined company after you put them together? Remember the two asset portfolio? You start every finance class with this. In foundations, you probably saw this equation, you've forgotten it. The variance in a two-asset portfolio is the weight of the first asset squared times the variance of the first asset, plus the weight of the second asset squared times the variance of the second one, plus two times weight one, weight two, covariance term. See, why are we talking about two-asset portfolios if we're in a valuation class? The combined company is going to have a variance based upon that equation, which means the variance of the combined company is going to be lower. It's 0.154, which is lower than the variance of either firm A or firm B. Why is that happening? That's the diversification effect. You're saying, I told you the company is going to get less risky. That decline in variance is not going to increase your value, because your investors could have done that themselves, and that's why we look at only the non-diversifiable risk. But here's where it's going to impact you. Here's my value for firm A. Here's my value for firm B. Here's my value for the combined firm. 100 plus 150, combined firm's value is 250. No value gain, no value lost. But my value of equity, when I combine the firm, is actually $3 million less than it was before I combine the firm. So tell me intuitively why equity investors are losing value in a fair value acquisition. What is it about this process that's causing me to lose value as an equity investor? Go ahead, Darshan. Or Perry, sorry. Perry, go ahead.
Is it fair to say that the debt value is increasing because the risk of the debt lender is reducing?
Absolutely.
Now they're on both the assets.
In fact, they lent money to each of the firms based on the risk of the firms. The combined firm is safer, so guess what? Their debt just got safer, but they still have the same interest rate they had before the merger. So pushback, tell me what you would do right after the merger to claw your money back. If you're the equity investor, what are you going to go?
Go to the bank and tell them I can put a refinancing unless it reduces the interest rates.
Exactly. Or here's another one. If they refuse, you know what you can do? You decided how to fund the acquisition, right? Use a lot more debt on the acquisition because you now have debt capacity. So either demand a higher interest rate, but if the banks draw the line and say, no, we won't do that, we have a contractual claim here, try to reclaim some of the increase in value by borrowing more on the deal. So that's when conglomerate mergers, you should see increasing debt ratios over time, because if you don't, here's what's going to happen. The equity investors in the conglomerate, because that's the essence of a conglomerate, is you buy companies in different businesses, the equity investors will actually see a seepage in value even if you're paying fair market value on every single acquisition. So let's say you buy into this notion of equity as an option and you want to try it on a company. Well, the example I've given is very artificial, right? There are only two claim holders, debt and equity. There are no hybrids. There's only 1-0 coupon bond outstanding, and the debt is all due at the end of the life. And the value of the firm and the variance are all given to you. You're saying, how am I going to do this if I'm valuing United Airlines? Let's try this. Here are some of the ways you can value equity in a troubled firm. And for those of you who have troubled firms, troubled in the sense you're money losing and a lot of debt, kind of hang in here for the next couple of pages, because perhaps I can give you a chance of taking your firm that right now might have a negative equity value. So when I looked at your DCFs that you sent in, I think at least 10 or 15 people in the class ended up with a negative equity value. You're saying, how the heck do you end up with a negative equity value? You take the free cash flows, you discount back at the cost of capital, you come up with a value of $1 billion, right? Let's say your outstanding debt is $1.2 billion. $1.2 billion is higher than $1 billion, your equity is negative. And I know some of you said, did I do something wrong? And my answer was, if you're valuing Korean Airlines or Lufthansa, I'm not surprised your equity value is negative. But I'm now going to give you an opening to take companies like those and come up with a way of actually estimating a value for the equity as an option. So let's see how we get the inputs to this model for a real company, not the hypothetical. First, I need a value for the firm, right? There are a couple of ways you can do it. One is, if you want to cheat, you can take the market value of equity and debt you see out there. Cheating because you're taking them and reverse engineering and then you're coming up with new values, I wouldn't do that. The second, and this is my preferred approach, is go back to your DCF. Remember that present value, the cash flows, the value of the operating assets you got? Treat that as the S in the model. So the $1 billion that I came up with for my DCF becomes the S in the model. If you're a company with individual items, a real estate company with 5 real estate holdings, and you can get the market prices of those holdings, I have absolutely no qualms about bringing in the pricing of those assets if you liquidated them today, because you'd have to sell them. So either use a DCF model to come up with the value of the operating assets as S, or use just the pricing of the individual assets. So that becomes the S in the model. Let's talk about the variance in the firm value. If your stocks and bonds are both trading, then you can take a weighted average, just like that two asset portfolio. The messy part is, if you get to be a troubled company, your equity is doing strange things, your debt is doing strange things, you put two strange things together, you might get strange output. So here's my cheat solution. You're valuing a troubled airline, which is pretty much every airline. You know what you can use? Remember how we got bottom-up betas, where I said look up the business you're in and look up the beta for the business? I have a table on my website where I have variances in firm value by business. So if you have an airline, I'll tell you this is the typical variance in firm value based on historical data. You can use that and move on. If you want to do a Monte Carlo simulation, be my guest. Take the value of the firm, run the Monte Carlo simulations, use that standard deviation of variance in the option pricing model. So I've got S, I've got sigma. And here's where you're going to run into an issue. No trouble firm ever has one nice zero coupon bond outstanding. They have dozens of debt issues, some short term, some long term. So here's what I'd suggest. Take all of your debt, add it all up. Take the book value. Just take the book value of all of the debt, add it all up. Make it the equivalent of the face value of your zero coupon bond. You say, but I don't have one. Take the weighted maturity of when the debt comes to you. So if you have 2-year debt, 3-year debt, 5-year debt, 10-year debt, take the weighted maturity. Let's say it's 6 years. So here's what you're doing. You're taking all of your messy debt and replacing it with one zero coupon, 6-year bond, with the total debt you have due as the face value. I know it's cheating, but it'll make your life a lot simpler. Darshan, you have your hand up. I'm sorry, I kept going through. No?
I'm sorry, it's from finance.
Okay, that's fine. So I'm gonna try this on a company. It's a company I'm not sure you've heard of as a company, but if you lived in Europe or especially in the UK, you might have driven through the company's product, the Eurotunnel. It's a hole in the ground where cash goes in but never seems to come out. Originally, it was built with the objective of making money, but it's never made money as a company. And this was a valuation from way back in time, 1997. It had, at that time, it had an operating loss of 56 million, net loss of 685 million pounds. So it's a money-losing company. Its book value of equity was negative, which means it's been a money-losing company for a long time, because every time you lose money, your book equity gets marked down. And it had a huge amount of debt outstanding, 8.9 billion pounds, with very long-term debt in there, 10.93 years as the average duration. If you can do duration, great. If not, just use the maturities. So here's what I have. I have a money-losing company with a lot of debt. Yeah, kind of should fit the requirements for option pricing, right? So here's what I did first. I did a very optimistic discounted cash flow valuation. Why optimistic? Because I dug them out of the hole. I gave them positive margins in the future, assumed costs will decline. And I came up with a discounted cash flow value for the operating assets. So this is free cash flows discounted back at the cost of capital of 2.3 billion pounds. You remember how much money they owed? Let me go back to the previous page, 8.9 billion pounds. The value of the firm with optimistic assumptions is 2.3 billion pounds. If I stopped and asked you, would you pay for the equity in this company? Your reaction is going to be, are you crazy? Why would I pay for equity? You know why? Because they have 11 years left to expiration. Something good could happen. The Sultan of Brunei could say, well, I want this tunnel and I'll pay for $15 billion for it if you name it after me. So here's what I did to value it as an option. I wanted a standard deviation in value. And here, I didn't use the cheat because at that time there were very few infrastructure companies which were like toll road companies. Today I might be able to do it. But they did have both stocks and bonds trading. Their stocks had a standard deviation of 41%. So these are the Eurotunnel shares on the exchange. And the Eurotunnel bonds had a standard deviation of 17%. During the period that I estimated the standard deviation, the company was about 15% equity, 85% debt in market value terms, heavily levered. I computed the variance in firm value by taking equity weight squared times the variance of equity, debt weight squared times the variance of debt, plus two times the two weights, so basically the two asset portfolio equation. I came up with a variance of 0.0335. What does that tell me? The company's value is low, but there's a lot of uncertainty about value in the future. Again, if you don't want to do this, you can go back to the DCF and do a Monte Carlo simulation and use that standard deviation instead. I'm almost there. I used a 15-year bond rate to reflect the maturity of the option. And here's what I got. $2.3 billion is the S in the model. K is $8.9 billion. This is a deep, deep, deep out of the money option. You have 11 years to play the game. The variance is 0.0335 and the riskless rate is 6%. So I plugged in D1, D2, NFD1, NFD2. Oh, remind me again what NFD2 tells me. There's a 7.5% chance that this would be an in the money option. But in this case, in the money basically means that S is greater than K, the value is greater than the debt. which means there's a 92.5% chance of bankruptcy. Actually, I'm not surprised it's that high. But here's the almost miraculous bottom line. This is about as troubled a company as I've ever seen. But with 11 years to expiration, look at the value of the option, £122 million. The stock was actually trading at about £150 million. You could have used DCF and you said these people are crazy. You could have tried pricing and said these people are crazy. But the only way you can explain why people were paying for the equity is they were buying an option. When you buy an option, that option will have value as long as you have life left in the option. And I could do the same thing in computer and interest rate and the debt, huge spread over the risk-free rate, 7.65%. Why? Because there's a 92.5% chance of bankruptcy. I once reviewed a paper. I don't do much academic research anymore. I don't review too many academic papers. And this paper actually compared the estimated likelihood of bankruptcy based on bond ratings, which has been around a long time. And then he used an option pricing model to estimate the probability of bankruptcy. And he found, in hindsight, that the option pricing model gave better predictions of the probability of bankruptcy than taking a bond rating and going through all the mechanics and the historical data. It's an interesting twist on how you measure the likelihood of failure. So before I close up on real options, I want you to play the role of a vulture investor buying distressed equities. Not distressed debt, but distressed equities. So I'm going to throw some choices at you, and you tell me which kinds of companies you'd be more likely to invest in. So you're buying distressed equities, equities in troubled companies with lots of debt. Do you want long-term debt or short-term debt? So when you look at the maturity of the debt, would you want your debt to be long-term or short-term? Long-term, why? Because you get more time. You want risky businesses or safe businesses? Risky. Hey, you know what? Here's what I'd like you to do. You have access to S&P Capital IQ after this class is over. No, so don't waste your time right now on it. Go in and look for companies that have money losing, lots of debt, lots of long-term debt, and are also in risky businesses. You know what? You're going to find a lot of options. I'm not going to say you're going to make a lot of money by doing this, but it's a very different perspective on equities. When you buy equities in airlines, I hope you're not buying it for the dividends. You're not going to get any dividends. I hope you're not buying it for the cash flows, unless you like large negative cash flows. You should be thinking in terms of options, because that's where the payoff is going to come from when you think about investing in these companies. So here's the bottom line. There are real options all over the place. Most of them have no significant economic value. And when they do, applying option pricing models don't really work that well. So you're saying, why do we spend so much time on it? Because the insights you get when you think of something as an option are very different than the insights you get when you think about equities in healthy companies. And those insights will outlast the option pricing model. Perry?
Is it fair to assume that this is not very valid in financial services companies?
Financial service companies don't even try. Do you know why the optionality disappears?
Because of the debt fluctuating?
Because you can't go bankrupt.
The government
will step in and take over your bank. Banks can't go bankrupt because then the depositors will get...
Yeah. I was thinking of like a company which does capital good lending in India, Bajaj Finance, you might know.
That might be different because I don't know what the regulatory backstop is there. So I know that there are lots of financing companies in India which have done this. There you might get optionality, but in a traditional bank, you it'll break down. Yeah. And my concern even with the Bajaj Finances of the world is how much will the government view the societal cost of liquidation and step in and provide, maybe not a bailout, but essentially wipe out your equity and take over the company. So I think the real value from options is recognizing those insights, the value of flexibility, the reasons why companies should sometimes stay underlevered, and how sometimes equity starts to behave like an option. And right now we're at a moment where a lot of stocks, especially in infrastructure business with a lot of debt, will start to behave like options, which means they'll behave in strange ways. Risk goes up, you'll see the values go up. You say, what's going on here? Because the optionality is kicking in. Okay? So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Go ahead.
I was going to ask, for in case of PCG, PG&E, how do we bring in the fact that if there is an option, that option value is reduced by the fact that the government could wipe out the equity investment?
You'd almost have to step away from option. Remember we did decision trees earlier in the, very early in this section, we did decision trees and we said, instead of using option pricing, you can sometimes capture what's going to happen with the decision tree. With PG&E, that's what I would do, is rather than use optionality, is start thinking about all of the different scenarios that can unfold, and then you can bring in the scenarios where the government is going to step in and take over the firm and wipe out your equity and assign a probability.
Okay, so a decision tree scenario analysis?
Yeah, or a full-fledged decision tree. Scenario analysis, you might have seven scenarios, but here there are actually, the reason decision trees are richer than scenario analysis is it sequential. So you might have to get through step one to get to step two. It allows you to bring, so it's kind of a richer scenario analysis.
Thank you.
Okay. Oliver, I see you said Luckin Coffee. I'd be very, very careful of that company. That company's problems are not just that its value is down because things are not going well, but there's some accounting shenanigans that are, the optionality there can very quickly dissipate if there's fraud or other stuff going on. So it's a company worth looking at, but I think there's some interesting stuff going on there, which is not good for equity investors. Any final questions? Oliver, go ahead. No? Okay, so I'm going to end for the day, and if you do have a trouble company with a lot of debt, I will send you a spreadsheet. It's a 5-minute job. It's an add-on to your DCF, and it'll allow you to see whether your company should have a premium on top of its DCF value. Okay. Yep.
On the duration aspect of the option, we are considering the duration of the interest. So let us say you're valuing a company and it has like a month payment of $100 million, and you believe that there's a probability that they might not be able to pay this month, and that would...
You know what? It'll already get taken care of, because they will not pay the $100 million if their value as a firm is only $150 million. But if it's a $100 million debt payment that's coming due, and it's a $30 or $50 billion company, I can almost guarantee that they're getting over the $100 million. So when you have the imminent threat coming in, it's because the near-term debt payment is actually a very large number relative to the value of the firm. And if that's the case, your duration for your option will already be a very low number. So I'm saying let the maturity of the weighted duration take care of that problem for you. Because otherwise, you'll be putting scenario analysis on front of options, and it can get really messy. But my guess is, if you have a lot of debt coming due in the near term, the duration of your debt will already be a low number. And if it's a low number, your option value will also drop off very significantly.